This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. It's 1:06 p.m. I'm Jim Meadows filling in for Celeste Quinn. I first saw The Second City in performance in 1974. I was in high school, if I can give my own age away. I had heard an awful lot about them the years before that in places such as The Midnight Special, which, by the way, is still airing on our companion station on Friday nights, WILL-FM. A lot of Second City material shows up there. What I remember most about the show was the second half, which was the portion devoted to improvisation based on audience suggestions. And that's the point where I think really exciting things happen. For some reason, I remember a sketch in which a couple of personalities on a TV show cruelly made fun of short people. This was the audience suggestion, and it was just hard to believe because everything clicked so well on that skit that it was made up at the spot. Improvisation and satire has been the trademark of the Second City for more than 40 years. They've been tremendously influential on the American comedy scene. If you see people perform like Mike Myers, Bill Murray, the late John Belushi, Alan Arkin, Mike Nichols, and Elaine May, you're seeing people who came and got their start at the Second City. There have been books written about Second City over the years, but the first one in a long while is written by one of the founding fathers of the Second City. It's called The Second City Backstage at the World's Greatest Comedy Theater. It is a book and two compact discs, and it's written by Sheldon Patinkin. Sheldon Patinkin, who helped get the Second City started, was its artistic director during much of the 1960s, and he's joining us on the phone from Chicago. Mr. Patinkin, glad to have you with us on the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you first, you were there during the early days of the Second City. What
Even
got
before.
Before, and some of the theater groups that I guess could have been seen as the predecessors of Second City.
Well, there were two. One was the first one was called Playwrights Theater Club, and we did plays for close to 2 years. That was with Mike Nichols and Elaine May and Ed Asner, Barbara Harris. Paul Sills was the artistic director. And then the first improv one, which was opened by David Shepard, was called The Compass. And it ran for about a year and a half in Chicago and for a while in St. Louis and has been running on and off ever since.
What?
And that included Shelley Berman, and Alan Arkin started there before coming to Second City, Stiller and Mira, Alan Alda at one point, Godfrey Cambridge at one point, etc.
So just in the last 30 seconds, you've mentioned an amazing array of talent right there that got their start. Well,
we're very proud of our alumni list.
What were, going back to that time, going back to the late 1950s, what were you people looking for? What was it that that you wanted to do that you perhaps thought you weren't finding elsewhere on the theater scene?
Different things for different people. When David Shepard opened The Compass, he was looking to open a theater, a cabaret theater, that spoke to its audience. He actually wanted it to be written, but couldn't find people who scripts that suited him, so changed it to improv and had Paul Sills come in and get it going. Paul Sills' mother, Viola Spolin, created the improv games, published in a book called Improvisation for the Theater, and Paul has always been her main disciple and one of the primary teachers, besides Viola herself, of the improv games. That was of more interest to him than anything politically or socially to make comments on, although eventually that became important to him too. Second City itself was almost an accident. Bernie Solins, Paul Sills, and Howard Alk wanted to open a coffee shop where friends could sit around and talk and drink coffee and eat pastries and smoke and having a good, friendly, neighborly time. But there was this big space in the back of it, so they decided to open another place like The Compass, which they called Second City, and it took over immediately. But there were a lot of different reasons for it, but mainly Chicago at that time was barren of local theater. Off Theater in Chicago was road companies from New York of musicals and comedies, and usually with second and third rate casts. And it was getting to a point where there wasn't anything that anybody wanted to see anymore, and we wanted to do theater. And at the same time, we wanted to have something to say about what was going on in the world. And the two came together with Second City.
And that's hard to believe. Looking at the theater scene in Chicago now, which is very varied, Second City is a big part of that. But there's all types of theater now.
Oh, there are about 150 theaters in Chicago now.
But then virtually nothing.
Right, not virtually nothing.
It's you're essentially
except community theater mm-hmm. and school theaters and park district theaters.
Essentially the theater scene of a small downstate city.
Exactly.
Is what Chicago was. What was
except that we had all these shows playing downtown that were brought in from New York.
So I wanted to focus on, you brought it up, and that is the improv games of Viola Spolin and her son Paul Sills. What were they? What was their object?
They were originally created by Viola for teaching theater to children. She was working out of the Hull House, and she started creating what she called games in order to make them more palatable to children, to get them relaxed and able to just be present on stage without the embarrassment of what kids always have when they're in front of other kids, et cetera, et cetera. It moved from that to, well, different people have different ideas about the games, but the main thing is that they are about what goes on between people on stage. They are about the connections that we make as human beings. I use them, and a lot of people use them, not so much as performance techniques as for creating an ensemble, whether it be for a company or for a cast for a particular show or for a class. I'm the chair of the theater department at Columbia College in Chicago. Some people use improvisation for creating material, Second City. Some people use improvisation as itself an entertainment form. There's a lot of that in Chicago. I assume there's a lot of it around, where they play various games and do improvisations based around a form called the Herald, which was created by Del Close, another of the former artistic directors at Second City. There are Improv Olympics in Chicago now, where teams compete, which is the antithesis of what Viola created the games for and how Paul Sills teaches the games. They're not about competition. They're not about winning anything, which is, in a way, why games is slightly a misnomer. They're about creating together, and that's their main function.
Can you give an example of a game or an exercise which has been commonly used by the Second City performers?
Well, there are different kinds. There are the kinds that we use in the workshops, and there are the kinds that we use in performance. The performance games, which means that we take a suggestion directly from the audience and improvise on it immediately, rather than what you were talking about earlier. At the end of the regular show, we take suggestions from the audience, and we go back and scream at each other for 20 minutes or so, and then come back and with ideas and improvise on them. The games that we play in front of audiences are on the spot. We get a first line and a last line from an audience and a place for the scene to take place. We get an author for each member of the cast and a title of a story, and then the leader, the conductor, conducts the story by pointing to the different authors who, and as each person is pointed to, he or she has to continue the story, but in the style of the author that he or she has been given. There are dozens of performance games. The games that we play in workshops and in classes, there are such things as you can't say anything unless you first made physical contact with the person you're talking to. The entire scene is played as a silent movie. or the people on stage do the physical work, and they have counterparts off stage who do the dialogue, and the people on stage have to try and move their lips with the dialogue that's being improvised, and the people who are doing the dialogue have to try and coordinate what they're saying with what the people on stage are doing physically. It's all training stuff. It's all about seeing the other as clearly as you see yourself. In a way, most of contemporary acting in America and in England is a combination of, whether they realize it or not, Spolin and Stanislavski. Stanislavski, as used by the Actors Studio and a lot of other places, is about what's going on inside, and Viola's stuff is about what's going on between. The problem for me with Lee Strasberg and the Method School of Acting is that they really were entirely about what goes on inside, as a result of which they tended more to make each character into themselves rather than changing themselves a lot to whatever the character demanded. That doesn't happen with most training these days. I think even the Actors Studio isn't doing it anymore since Strasberg died. Anyway, I hate the Actors Studio. Go on.
Well, and
did I answer your question and all that?
I think I got to start here, and it brings up an interesting question for me, because when you're talking about different acting techniques, in conventional theater, if that's the right word, you're usually talking about there already being a script there that the actors are going to work
with. Well, that's true of the Second City show, too. After the pieces are created, whether they're written or improvised, then they have to be performed every night as if they were scripts.
Well, how does
That's one of the reasons why our alumni list is so impressive, because they get training as improvisers and as performers.
How does the improv process affect or inform the writing of the shows?
Usually when a piece is improvised in the set and works pretty well, which is maybe 30-40% of the time, well enough to be considered to be repeated and worked on as possible material for the next show, usually what happens is that it's improvised a couple more times in front of the audiences, and then either the videotape or the audio tape, we make both of every improv set, is transcribed with the best from each of the three or so that have been done, and then written from there. Sometimes someone comes in with an idea that is written and then improvised off of what's been written, using the dialogue, using the scenario, whatever it is, and that'll happen in rehearsals a lot. So it goes back and forth between writing and improvising until the piece and the show are created. Then it's scripted.
In your experience, are the shows different because it's not a matter of the cast going down and just sitting out and writing stuff and then coming back, but because improv played a role in the creative process?
Absolutely. It is why we've been going for 41 years in Chicago. And another, we have two theaters back-to-back in Chicago. The second one, which is called Second City ETC, has been going for close to 20 years. We have one in Toronto that's been going for close to 30, one in Detroit that's going toward 10, and we even just opened one in Las Vegas, which I think is weird, but nonetheless, it's there. That's because we stay current, and we stay constantly with what our audiences want us to be dealing with, because a lot of it comes from their suggestions about what they want to see dealt with.
I want to go to just a quick cut from the CDs that come with your book, and they're narrated by a Second City alum from your time at the theater,
right?
Robert Klein.
Robert Klein, Fred Willard, and David Steinberg were all in the same company, which I was the director of. It was a good company.
And let's just go to a quick break from the CD that goes along with the Second City backstage at the world's greatest comedy theater.
By the time Jack and Avery were making their leap to television, Second City was becoming the place to find up-and-coming talent. That's when yours truly joined the troupe. Here's my pal Fred Willard and myself in a blackout called Mary Smith.
Now to begin our festivities, Mary Smith will sing the Star-Spangled Banner.
Mary Smith is a whore!
Nevertheless, Mary Smith will sing the Star-Spangled Banner.
Now, over the years, what I came to know Robert Klein and Fred Willard for doing in the years after Second City was mostly stand-up comedy, I think, for Robert Klein. And
but also a lot of acting. Mm-hmm. Robert's a good actor. He's even won a Tony, as a matter of fact, for a play that he was in.
And Fred Willard is, perhaps he's one of the greatest straight men in comedy I've ever seen.
You bet.
And
he was in Second City too. Fred Willard could make me laugh almost any time he wants to, even sometimes when he doesn't particularly want to. He's a very funny man.
And it's something when people see the straight man in a comedy team or in an ensemble, they may not think of him as being the one who may be as essentially pushing the humor, because somebody else seems to be the greater object of the laughs.
But, well, he was Martin Mull's straight man on Fernwood Tonight, and he was every bit as funny as Mull. He plays a lot of strangely stupid characters, although Fred himself is not in any way stupid. He just won an award as Best Supporting Actor from some comedy organization for his performance in Best of Show. That dog show movie.
Mm-hmm, with Christopher Guest, I believe.
Yeah. By the way, as you probably tell from the bit that you played, all of the stuff on both CDs is stuff that was taped live at Second City and performance in front of audiences. Going back to the very first thing in the very first Second City show, which is a song sung by Barbara Harris, and all the way through to Chris Farley's motivational speaker, as a matter of fact, is on there because that was created at Second City, and then he was given permission to do it on Saturday Night Live. And the two CDs, they were tough to figure out because we had to find things that worked for the ear only. And an enormous amount of our material you have to see as well as hear, including some of our most repeated scenes by touring company people. So what we did was we went through all the files and all the archives. Midnight Special, by the way, for many years taped opening night of every show, which is why the Midnight Special has always been playing a lot of Second City stuff. We pulled out stuff we thought would work from the various tapes that we had and played them for people who didn't know the material, and that way came up with stuff that we think works just for the ear.
You were the artistic director during much of the 1960s, and
right.
You were directing the Second City shows then. What was it like putting together a show? This is not like sitting down and deciding what your interpretation of Othello was going to be.
I think that directing Second City is the worst job I've ever had as a director. Certainly the most difficult. Not the worst, but the most difficult.
You did it for about 5 years, I think.
I used to break out in bad stomach aches and bumps right before it was time to go into rehearsal of a new show. And the bumps wouldn't go away until the show opened. This finally occurred to me as being psychological stress. What it is in a lot of ways, you are head writer, so to speak, and director. It's just that you find yourself frequently giving notes to the writers and getting responses from the actors, or giving notes to the actors and getting responses from the writers, who are, of course, the same people. It can get very difficult. I never really loved the job, if the truth be known, but I wanted to do it, I wanted to learn how to do it, and I wanted to learn what there was to learn from doing it. With our TV show, SCTV, I learned an enormous amount because I was in charge of post-production. As one of the associate producers, I learned huge amounts about how to edit your stuff.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Sheldon Patinkin. He is one of the founding fathers of the Second City Company in Chicago, the author of a new book on the Second City, and we'd like to take a caller now who I believe has a comment or a question. Line one from Urbana, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Mr. Meadow, and hi, Mr. Patinkin.
Hi.
I have two questions for you. I just put them out at once so I can get off the line. One is, I seen very little live theater, but I seem to have noticed among the theater students, there are people who are acting all the time, even during their spare time, they're very good at portraying things. They can be anything. And then there are other types who just, you know, they act like normal people, but once they get on the stage, there's something
really. You mean
really
theater people aren't normal people when they act like theater people?
No. Well, yeah, I have my preference, but I'm saying that the second type, they seem to actually turn out to have something deeper in them. So I'm wondering if this somehow, I couldn't really figure this out. As I said, I have my preference, but I want to hear your comment. I wonder if it's connected to what you were saying earlier, like method acting or that sort of thing. Also, I'm wondering who had a better chance to make it to Hollywood. And my second question is, you were talking about using the improv comedy not only as sort of a performance vehicle for the actors and also as a maybe as a teaching tool for both the artist and maybe also the audience conducting it in some workshop form. Can you talk more about that? Okay, thank you very much. I'll hang up and listen.
Those are complicated questions to answer quickly. The first one, most people who work in comedy are very serious people. It's hard work. As Groucho Marx once said, dying is easy, comedy is hard. Very few people from my many years of experience with comedy performers and with actors in general, very few of them need to be funny when they're not working. They're quite like everybody else, only they can be funnier or know how to be funnier. And most theater people, once they get out of college, stop acting so theatrical when they're not dealing with their work. It's not something most people do once they're professionals. I think I know what kind of behavior you're talking about, and it's very flamboyant and very whatever. But that disappears with time. Now, second question. I do not enjoy, this is just personal, because I've seen improvisation over so many millions of improvisations in my life. I don't enjoy going to a theater or a cabaret to watch people improvise all night, because the chances of failure are very high, or they're just making jokes, neither of which to me is a source of entertainment, particularly the just making jokes part of it, or the trying to be the best one on stage at any given time, which happens a lot in things like the Improv Olympics. I don't enjoy that because I don't think that's what improvising is about. I think improvising is about creating between.
That would be seen to be the trick for a performer, not the trick, but the really challenge is to not just to be able to improvise, but to react to what your fellow actors are doing.
Del Close put it most succinctly, I think, when he told one of the actors in his company, I think it was Harold Ramis, as a matter of fact, your job is to make everyone else look good, and then you'll look good too. And that's what we use improvisation for. As a classroom exercise, in theater classes, it's used a lot to create various kinds of what's going on inside, what's going on between, how to work on different kinds of characters, how to work on different kinds of places, etc. It's also used by businesses for training people. We have an organization as part of Second City, which we call BizCo, which does industrial shows or goes to businesses and holds workshops with their employees. Improvisation is used in a lot of different fields, not just to create comedy.
We're talking with Sheldon Patinkin, who is a founding father for the Second City and its artistic director for much of the 1960s.
Now, I'm still the artistic consultant, by the way, which means I go in and watch previews of shows and give notes afterwards to the actors and directors.
So you still see the shows on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah.
And the current shows in Chicago, I did want to note that right now, performing at the Second City in the main stage is Slaughterhouse 5, Cattle Zero, directed by Jeff Richmond. And on the main stage, they have the one of the touring companies doing the Best of Second City on Monday nights. And then up the street a little bit at Second City ETC is Better Late Than Nader, directed by Dexter Bullard. When you're dealing with collections of sketch comedy here, is it possible to sum up the shows? Can you say
the titles usually have nothing whatsoever to do with the shows?
Is there,
as a matter of fact, I never remember from time to time what the title of that show was.
Well, is there anything?
Because they're hardly ever connected to what's going on.
Is there anything in these two shows that stands out for you? These two shows currently running.
I think they're both very good shows. As a matter of fact. They're very different. The one up front, the main stage one, Slaughterhouse, is quite dark, and the one in back is quite silly in a lot of ways. They're both very funny. They both have a good chunk of political satire in them. We don't always have as much political satire as I think we should have in our shows. But both of these deal with it. There have been shows that I would not be saying this about, but I really do think these are both quite good.
It's interesting, the mention of political satire, which happens a lot, but it's not always a constant. And I got the impression from your book that it's really a matter of the times, mm-hmm. and what's going on and to what degree people and the people in the show are concerned with these matters.
Well, it's more to what degree the audience is concerned with it.
Because it will come up in the improv suggestions.
Exactly, and because we'll try stuff out, and if they don't know what the hell we're talking about, it doesn't work.
Well, so for instance, when you were artistic director, when controversy was heating up over the Vietnam War, and when there were demonstrations in Chicago, and...
I was lucky enough to be artistic director during the time when JFK was assassinated, the Chicago Democratic Convention went on, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, Martin Luther King was assassinated with the riots that went with that. I was lucky enough to be the artistic director during all of that. There were periods of time during all of that and afterwards when we couldn't do much political satire because people were not willing to laugh at it. Or in the case of... the show that we opened at the time of the Democratic Convention, which was called The Plague on Both Your Houses, we were so angry that the material was more satiric than it was funny.
How did you deal with that? How quickly did things come up in performance?
Night when it was in the papers that day. On television that day.
So something like when the riots were going on during the convention, it showed up in performance very quickly.
Well, it showed up outside our doors. We really couldn't do much about it. I mean, it was the kids were being chased out of the park at curfew time, right towards Second City, along with the tear gas. We could see kids being beaten up by the cops right across the street from us, against the wall of a Walgreens drugstore that was there. Still is there, as a matter of fact. One of our actors got beaten up because he was outside when it was going on. It was a very, very, very bad time.
Here's a satirical segment, and this is from many years later. But let's go ahead with this piece, which I believe, again, is introduced by Robert Klein.
Religion has long been one of the favorite topics at the Second City, and no faith has come out completely unscathed. In 1998, the cast created a rather controversial version of the Lord's Prayer. The cast here includes Kevin Dorff, T.J. Jagodowski, Stephanie Weir, Susan Messing, Tammy Sager, and Rich Tallarico.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And one more thing. Help us eliminate homosexuality from the human race in a way that won't make us look mean. grant the women of our faith the serenity to accept the fact that they will never be priests. Never, never in a million years. Could you make every woman who is pro-choice barren? Kind of a nip it in the bud thing. Get our priests to stop fondling children. Or at least, get the children to quit talking about it. Could you move Hanukkah to another month? So the cross and Christmas trees don't have to share space with the Star of David and that candle thingy. Amen.
And that's the Second City from 1998.
Kevin Dorff is now writing for Conan, and Stephanie Weir is now a regular on Mad TV.
So they've moved into the business pretty quick.
Oh yeah.
You folks get scouted out by
constantly in all of our places. Saturday Night Live comes in a couple of times a year at least. They all do. We get producers, directors, agents, you name it, coming in whenever they can get to Chicago, whenever they can get to Toronto, those two places in particular. There's hardly ever been a Second City cast, a Saturday Night Live cast, both good or bad, that hasn't had at least one or two alumni in it. And starting with the first company, Gilda and John Belushi and Danny Aykroyd, and a year later Bill Murray were all Second City people.
Now, for people who come out of Second City, of course they want to break into bigger show business. But do they find that business after Second City to be more of a constraint compared to what they were doing on your stage?
Most of them tend to say that the happiest times in their careers were when they were creating stuff at Second City. But they sure do like the money they make now.
That does make a difference, I guess.
You bet.
It's hard to make a lifetime living at Second City, I would guess.
Actually, most of the Second City people, once they get into Second City, also tend to get a lot of commercials and stuff like that, so that they make a decent living, but nothing like the living that they're going to make if they move on to L.A. or New York and get into TV and film.
We're talking with Sheldon Patinkin, a consultant and one of the founding fathers, one-time artistic director with the Second City, now chair of the theater department at Columbia College Chicago. You work with the summer workshops at the Steppenwolf Theater and the acting faculty of the Chicago Lyric Opera Center for American Artists. Also the author of a new book on the Second City. If you have a question, we have about 11 minutes left in this part of Afternoon Magazine. Please give a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Second City is not just in Chicago. It has gone to other cities at various times over the years.
Yeah, we had one in New York for several years in the 60s. Which we closed down mainly because we couldn't keep a company together for long enough to create new shows. They were constantly being picked up by TV and by film and Broadway. The same thing happened when we tried to have one in the L.A. area. We just couldn't keep companies together long enough. We now have two in Chicago, as I said, one in Detroit, one in Toronto, which has been going for quite a long time. And where quite a few of our famous alumni came from, including Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie, who are on Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Ryan's also on What's-His-Name sitcom. And Danny Aykroyd is from the Toronto Company. Marty Short's from the Toronto Company. And we are about to open one in Cleveland. Three weeks ago, open one at the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas.
Now that has to be an interesting crowd.
I guess so. I've never been to Las Vegas. I have no desire to go, and I have not been asked to go there to check out the show, so I'm perfectly happy with things as they are.
Now, with companies in other cities, do the different cities affect the shows? I mean, is Second City in Toronto or Detroit different from Chicago?
Oh, sure. We rarely even exchange material, as a matter of fact. We do to some extent. Partly we don't exchange material because the companies resent being asked to do other people's material. That's for touring companies as far as everybody. We have three touring companies working out of Chicago, one out of Detroit and one out of Toronto, and they do best of material from earlier shows. Travel literally all around North America, mostly to colleges and community centers and stuff like that. The Toronto audiences are different, the Detroit audiences are different, and therefore the shows are different. I would suspect that the Las Vegas audiences are different. One thing that they learned during previews is that the Las Vegas audiences are not willing to laugh at sketches about gambling.
It's serious business for them.
Huh? Uh-huh. So there are no scenes about gambling in the Second City show in Las Vegas.
Now, has it been the goal over the years, and maybe something more clearly seen when the company was just starting out, to get a different relationship with the audience at Second City than in a conventional theater, even a conventional comedy review?
Oh, well, there's no fourth wall. At Second City, between the audience, the fourth wall concept, which was started by Stanislavski, which is that where the audience is, there is a fourth wall, an imaginary one that cuts off any acknowledgement on the part of the people on stage that there are people watching them. We talk to the audience. Not just when we take suggestions from them, which is part of the breaking of the fourth wall, but also we introduce some of the scenes, especially when people have to change costumes backstage and don't have enough time to do it. We take suggestions from the audience during the show itself for an occasional spot improv. The relationship between the audience and the stage at Second City has always been, look what we're like. It's never, look what you're like. We're not pointing fingers at the audience and excluding ourselves. We include ourselves in what's wrong and with what we need to satirize and what we need to talk about, because we're part of it. We learn from the audience as much as they learn from us.
Now you also worked. In a production where you didn't have the audience feedback in the same way. You were with the SCTV TV series
for the first 26 half-hour episodes, the first season, which actually took close to 2 years.
Now that was a different challenge, I guess, because you didn't have an audience,
and because we didn't know what the hell we were doing, so we just did it. None of us knew what we were doing. We were taken up by the smallest of the three networks in Canada called Global, which had no money whatsoever. So we decided to do a show which was a day's programming at a very, very bad TV station with no money. We did parodies of TV shows. We also did what was going on backstage at the TV show, at the TV station. And some of the material that we used was stuff that had been created on stage. Most of it was written for the show itself. But the writing of the material for SCTV, a lot of it was done around the table by the performers improvising and then getting it down on paper.
There was something, as I watched that show over the years, I don't know why the word layering comes on, but there was always a lot of things that seemed to be going on in many of those sketches. A lot of extended gags that were that the more you watched the show, the more you got.
Oh, we had a lot of running characters. That was part of the plan from the beginning. As a matter of fact, the very first show was more about what was going on backstage with Johnny LaRue, played by John Candy, than it was parodies of shows that were the day's programming. But we only had 22 minutes, and we'd written like 40 minutes of material and shot like 40 minutes of material, so we had to drop a lot of it. Once the show went to an hour and a half, when it went to NBC, then there was a lot of what was going on backstage as well.
I was wondering, with the company now being 40 years old, and when you look at Second City shows now and look at the, think of the shows that you directed, for instance, has Second City changed in a substantial way?
Not in what you might consider substantial. The form has changed several times. During the 60s especially, we frequently did shows where the scenes were longer. As a matter of fact, several shows, the whole second act was one scene. And one show was a scenario from beginning to end with continuing characters. It didn't work very well. We never did that again. But for the most part, the form has always been a series of sketches, scenes, short scenes, blackouts, musical numbers, and an occasional on-the-spot improv, strung together into two acts that hopefully build correctly. But now there's another form that began in the mid-90s based on the improv game called The Herald, where scenes don't finish but come back later, where there are running characters as well as different characters, and where the whole thing is basically built off of a particular topic, and all of the scenes in the show somehow or other illustrate or come off of that topic. That's now one of the forms that we use as well.
I think we have, I want to finish off our segment with this one last call that's coming in, and I want to say hello to line one from Urbana. Good afternoon, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. This is really a thrill. And I was up at the protest in Quebec City last week, where, by the way, there was also a lot of beating and gassing going on. But I was sitting in a gym where we were being put up for the nights we were there, and talking with two people I'd never seen before in my life, and one from way up north of Vancouver and one from Los Angeles, and reminiscing about the SCTV TV program. And
it's back on the air.
Someone told me that there were reruns in Canada.
Well, there are now reruns in America very late at night. They have replaced the NBC show Later.
And it's on NBC?
Right. Here in Chicago, so I guess there as well. It's on at 12:35 on NBC in the morning.
Yeah, when it was on before, like years and years ago, before there were VCRs, unfortunately, so I didn't ever have tapes of it. But I used to stay up till 2:30 in the morning just to watch that show.
Well, actually, apparently NBC is also going to be releasing some videos in the fall.
Oh, that would be so great. You know,
thanks.
A lot of people remember that show and love it.
It was a wonderful show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and with that, we'll have to close out this segment. Sheldon Patinkin, thank you very much for spending his time with us here to talk about The Second City.
Thank you. I hope people buy the book. It's $45, including the two CDs. This is my pitch. Available at bookstores everywhere and online on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and SecondCity.com.
The book is The Second City, Backstage at the World's Greatest Comedy Theater, published by Sourcebooks of Naperville. As you mentioned, the Second City website is secondcity.com. A lot of information there about Second City, its history, and current shows if you want to find out more about this long-running comedy troupe.